the Off the Ball Podcast Network.
You ain't shit.
I wish I was 50 years younger and I'd kick your ass.
But fans can be the harshest critics, you know.
And they often are.
A wife is often the harshest critic of her husband.
I thought I was invincible. That's what you're trained to believe as a sports person.
There was 4 million people in Ireland who knew much more about managing football teams than I did. When it comes to music, I can spoof it the best.
Your sporting career is the best time you'll have. And, you know, you have to hang on to it for as long as your life, because everything else is pretty crappy.
And this is not light. Stephen Rothschild has never spoken to Jimmy McGuinness in his life.
I'm going to get our roadshow underway with two very special guests. Andy Lee, putting the kids to bed, will be here in a matter of minutes. But let's get our first guests up on stage. First, please give it up for four-time All-Ireland winner and the man behind the shot clock, Kieran Donaghy. And a man whose best days in sport are yet to come. Yes, he may have played 110 times for Ireland, never missed an international for 10 years. But the next 6 months are going to define his sporting legacy. The star of Dancing on Ice, it is Kevin Kilbane. Well, well, well.
Yeah.
A world exclusive. Kevin Kilbane is yet to officially talk about this breaking news. Hello Magazine are here. VIP Magazine are here.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Live and ready to find out. What is going on?
I don't know what's going on. Honest to God, I don't. It's been a mad couple of weeks. I mean, you know what's going on. You know behind the scenes. About a year ago, I got asked to do the show originally. So I got asked to go down to London and they interviewed me. And anyway, it was just...
How does the interview go for Dancing on Ice?
Well, there was an interview on ice, actually. Yeah, you have to get on the ice and show them how good or how bad you are.
Did you do a twirl?
Oh, God. I can actually ice skate. I can go probably as far as the end of the room and back. I can't stop myself. I can't turn. So basically, I'm a total novice, yeah? So I did a little bit of an audition, and they asked me to do it. I'd have gone on purely for the novelty value, or just to people to can laugh at me, as it will be this year as well. So they asked me to do it last year, and I said no. I just didn't fancy it. I was probably a little bit nervous, didn't fancy it. And I've told you about it anyway. The lads would have known about this. And I said no. And then this year, they've come back on quite strong again. So in the last couple of weeks, they've been on to me and they said, look, we'd love you to do it. We were really impressed with what you said last year. I don't know what I said now. I can't remember what I did say to them. But yeah, they want you to do it. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. So that's what I did. And I just decided to go with it, yeah.
And what is your dancing experience?
Coppers. I've got no dancing experience. I've got, honest to God, I'm limited in every way. It's certainly limited on the ice, which is intimidating enough, but limited in terms of dancing. So, yeah, it's going to be a mad few months, I think. Yeah, the way it's going to go for me. Yeah,
I'm quite nervous for you. I got to be honest, because yeah. this is national TV.
I'm sweaty pants.
Sunday night.
I'm sweating even talking. I told the lads we were out on Friday night. Us and myself and a few of the lads were out Friday night. We were actually in here, and we went out for a few drinks in town. And Nathan came late, so I told the lads I was going to do it. And then I said to Nathan, look, I've decided I'm going to do it. It'll be announced probably Wednesday, but I'm going to agree to do it. So Nathan looked me up and down and said, mate, you want to go to the gym. I'm telling you now, you want to go to the gym now because you're going to be in leotard, you're going to be in... And the reality hit me. So I thought to myself today, I said, right, first of all, I'm going to start eating healthily and I'm going to stay off the booze. So today I've had about 5 snack bars with about 10 cups of tea and I've just drinking my first pint of lager. So yeah, so that's going down well
Things
already.
Things are going well.
Don't forget the fish and chips.
And the fish and chips, yeah.
Our third special guest has arrived. We'll get him straight up on stage. Give it up for former world boxing champion, Andy Lee. How are you? So you're the good people from Dundrum and Ice are here. You're going to be their best customer, are you, for the next 3 or 4 months?
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. Where are they? Was it you I was talking to today? So yeah. Brendan, sorry, it was Brendan, yeah. So I got a DM today from Brendan. He messaged me. So I'm hopeful. Some of the training I was meant to do, it's meant to be in Manchester, and I was like, I live in Dublin now, so hopefully I can do it here. So I'd be talking to you afterwards, and hopefully, yeah. It's not my... Make sure you charge ITV a big rate as well. That's what I'll say to you as well, yeah.
Why, when are we going to see you on reality TV?
Not...
I turned on Dancing with the Stars last year, to be honest. Yeah. Size 13 shoe, I capsized some young one and down the top for him. And be the laughing stock of the world on Twitter for, or Ireland on Twitter for a night. So, yeah, no.
You must have been tempted.
No, I wasn't. And they were kind of, and they were like, look, come up and talk this. We haven't even mentioned money. I said, you, I don't, you can have all the money in the world. I used to get nervous watching Mahoney doing it. My hands used to be sweating. Like Kevin was talking about it there. I was just like going, because it's so much out of his comfort zone. He's a brave boy. So you got,
well, you've seen
Aidan
O'Mahony's body, Kev. That's what you need
a bit
to
of
go
work
to.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean.
Aidan might do the training.
I might go and see him, actually. See if he can do me a little bit of personal training. So that's he'll be the man for that, yeah.
He's a selector with me with the college, so I'll talk to him for you.
Have a word. Is he based in Dublin?
He can come up to Dublin for the right money.
Yeah.
Is this whole panel about Kev doing Dance with the Stars?
Yes.
Dance on Ice?
To think we got you out of bed for this. Have you done any reality TV?
No.
Have you been offered it?
No.
Not yet?
Not suited, no.
Would you Dancing with the Stars?
No.
Come on.
Just going to say no the whole time. No, I wouldn't. It's not a good fit, is it?
I tell you,
You've too much self-respect.
No.
Last year, I was in the exact same boat, and I said, no, definitely no. Under any circumstance, I will not be doing it. And then...
What's your motivation?
Motivate, right, do you know what it was? He'd come to me. I say, certainly not money. Money's okay, don't get me wrong. But do you know what it was? It was just they came to me and they pushed me and they said, look, we would love you to do it. And the agent, I don't have an agent. So it was an agent who rang me up, who's put me in there. And he said to me, look, I think it'd be good for you. Just go and do it. Have a bit of a laugh. And I just thought to myself, look, what else am I going to be doing? I've got three months to learn a new skill and I'm going to enjoy it.
And it's on ITV, it's huge coverage. It will do, like, there'll be a huge other benefits. But Dancing with the Stars on RT on a Saturday night, it's a big difference, isn't it?
You know? What he's doing is massive, yeah.
At the moment, Kev can walk into 37 on a Saturday night and everyone turns around and look. When he's in Manchester in the equivalent, you know, it doesn't quite happen. By the time this is finished, this man's going to be a superstar.
Especially if he capsizes someone and ends up dying.
It's gone off on the tangent that we didn't really want.
I know.
We all know what's going to be the first song, I presume. Ice, Ice Baby.
That's what all my mates are sending me messages and the videos of me doing that song in the past, yeah. So, yeah. Unfortunately, it's probably going to have to come out at some stage, isn't it?
Are you going to be pulling on the green jersey? Is this very much you're representing Ireland?
Oh, yeah.
Post-Brexit?
Yeah, we'll have the green and red as well. Of course we will, yeah, definitely.
Green and red and mayo?
Of course, 100%. Definitely. Every song, maybe a bit of we might have a bit of the Wolf Tones as well, which was suggested to me as well today, which might not be appropriate over
Who
there.
The
but it's been
that?
On BBC this year, so we'll get it on ITV as well.
Talking about representing Ireland, one of the things we want to talk to you all about, because you've all represented Ireland on different stages. Kieran, you got the opportunity with the international rules many times, and you've spoken about that opportunity and what it meant to you to go abroad, to go to Australia, to very much feel like you're representing your country. And I know you took it very seriously.
Yeah, I took it seriously. Of course, I took it seriously, but I enjoyed myself as well, as you do when you're... It was very new to us to go on tour, you know. The lads would be more used to going away and for pre-season tournaments. And for us, it was very new. But I was lucky enough to go on two of them, but... Yeah, we enjoyed ourselves as well after the business was taken care of course. There was bits in between as well where you might have gone a bit haywire. There was
Well, when you think back to when you were getting involved in international rules, it was around the time of the almighty scrap in Croke Park where people thought it was dead and buried. Like, it was tough on the field as well.
Yeah, it was. And look, the Aussies were, you know, they're a very proud nation. We were going over there and it was on the back of that, so we went over to take care of business, and we won the first game out in Perth in the Subiaco by a point, and it was a bit lighter. I was talking to David Moore, and he said, Jesus, you sold the international trip to be a mighty thing. He said in his version 3 or 4 years ago, there was no drink, there was no out, it was all serious stuff, but we won on a Friday night in Perth, and we went out around Subiaco, out around that area, Subi, and the following night, we flew to Melbourne, and we got a bus then, a flight that took 6.5 hours, by the way, for not really geography in school would be
you
my best.
You discovered that Australia was big halfway through the flight.
I got onto the flight basically after a horror night of drinking Clawlors, no sleep, onto the plane, kind of expecting maybe...
Dublin to Farran 4.
No, not Dublin to Farran 4, but like, you know, I was hoping for kind of maybe a 2 or 3 hour flight, and your man said it was going to be 7.5 hours, and I said, oh, Jesus Christ almighty, the sweats had already started. So there was no sleep from a lot of us, especially the fellas that stayed out very late. We got there, we got a bus up to this Apollo Bay place where we were doing a training camp starting the following morning, and we were just pulling in around the corner to the hotel, and Sean Boylan was just giving the speech at the top of the bus, like, you know, to get a good night's rest and that tomorrow was going to be important to get off to the right note and put away the result that we got the last night. It's going to be different and harder down in the MCG in Melbourne the following week. And but just as we were passing, there was just like these little kind of tiny little windows, disco lights and strobe lights, and a few of us got a bit kind of few notions as we passed. So we pulled up anyway, and we were checking into the hotel, and we all went off to our rooms, and myself, I don't think I was the ringleader. I might have been. Me, Joe McMahon, and Finian Henley from Galway went down to the porter with $50 and told him, come up here, went to chat with him to open the back door of the hotel and that we'd be back later on and give us his number. So he let us back in. So the management, because they'd be strolling around the hotel and you just wouldn't want to bump into them. And went down and went out into the bar, and geez, the place was hopping. It was mighty, mighty crack, as you'd imagine. We took off straight, because we didn't have much time. It was like 11 o'clock, so we took straight at the vodka. And that was going grand. And we it didn't end there outside. Then there was more crack outside. And there was the owner of the bar, who we got talking to, landed out with a few more bottles and went to bed at about 5 o'clock, I'd say, maybe 6 o'clock, and next morning I got up and, Jesus Christ, we were dying, me and Finian were in the room. Joe had to go into a room with somebody else who didn't even know he was out. He said he was going for a coffee or something about 11 o'clock. But me and Finian anyway went out and we got onto the bus, and I remember going up, sitting next to Sean Boylan, who's the great Irish manager, and the mead man, and so I sat down kind of the row behind him, I sat in next to him. And I was kind of talking out the side of my mouth, and he was like, "Are you all right? You're very quiet, Kieran," because I wouldn't be quiet normally. And I goes, "Jesus, yeah, Sean, the jet lag from that flight is me killed." He says, "Go way back into bed there and take the morning off and don't worry about it for yourself." So I headed off the bus, and just as I was walking in, I looked up and Finian and Joe looked out the window and I was like waving at them. So yeah, they were great days, now I must say. And we beat them in Melbourne the following day by a pint as well, so beat them by 2 overall. So. You can have the cracker, but once you deliver on the pitch is the main thing.
I know you took it very seriously as well, Kevin, obviously, with the Republic of Ireland. We're coming up in 10 years since Thierry Henry's handball. Like, a devastating night that you just couldn't get over. Yet, I heard a rumour that you brought the owner of 37 on the plane back to Dublin that night so he'd open the pub for you when you landed in Dublin. Just to drown your sorrows?
Part of that's true, yeah. A lot of that's true, actually. But, we had a session after that, yeah. But that was after the game, wasn't it? We were supposed to go back to our clubs the following day, but a lot of us, probably all of us, missed flights, I think, that following day. And we ended up staying in Dublin. We ended up in Swords to start with. And the only thing I remember, a couple of lads had to do, we were asked the night before, can you do an interview on TalkSport? Can someone do an interview on Five Live, or whatever it would be? And I think it was, Keith Andrews might have had to do an interview on Sky. So Keith was doing an interview on Sky. So Keith was on one screen, and then somebody else was doing an interview over here, a phone interview with TalkSport, and someone else was doing an interview on Five Live. And the three lads, you can see them, and this was 5, 6 o'clock in the morning. We were in 6 o'clock in the morning. Lads have been drinking all night from that game. So literally we got up, we finished at 11 o'clock. Well, it would have been about 11 that night, probably when the game finished up. And we got back into Dublin about 2:30, I think it was. And yeah. We had an almighty session after that game. Yeah, it was. It was considering what had happened, we did actually have a great night. But we did actually. But
nothing clearly was.
I think
you
the reality hit home probably on the Friday when we all sobered up after that game. Yeah. I think. Yeah.
You obviously played a lot with Niall Quinn, who'd be very much the link to the Charlton years and the previous era. Did you feel that? Almost that was left behind that side of it a little bit?
When I first came in, yeah, definitely after Jack, Mick was certainly a lot more disciplined with us. It was always at the right time. And anyone would say that now. I don't think We could have maybe got the results that we did if we were out on the piss. We couldn't do it, and that was a fact. So usually it would have been summer games if we had a doubleheader across the summer, which usually would have been, as you know yourselves now, probably the 7th and 11th of June or something. We would have certainly had a big blowout after the last game. And certain games where we might have had an easier game coming up, we may have ventured out after one or two of those games. That's kind of how it would have gone for us. But Quinny certainly, he stuck to Big Jack's rules, yeah. So Quinny didn't bother what Mick was telling us half the time, yeah.
Are you looking at these two, Andy Gunn? This isn't proper sport. This isn't how you treat your body.
No, we would have had those years as well, especially early on when I was coming into the team. And it, like, you know, that transition from the old way into the new modern way, which most sports are now. That was a big transition. It was very hard for a lot of the older guys to adjust to, you know, being told that they could, like, because that was it. You'd go out, you'd have your fight, win or lose, you'd have a few drinks after it, like when you'd be abroad in whatever country you'd be. And that was part of part of the reward for winning the national title, that you'd be representing Ireland, going to all these countries, and yeah, you get to see somewhere else. So when they couldn't do that, it was hard for them. But no, I don't want to reveal any details, but not as much as these lads. But yeah, I was there for some nights.
I think it was a difficult adjustment for a lot of lads that had that from when they'd first played. Yeah, 20 years in a career. Say I would have been playing with Niall and Steve Staunton, these lads, Ray Houghton when I first got in, Andy Townsend. These lads had been from a culture of the Tuesday clubs, the Wednesday club, the Sunday clubs, the Friday clubs, whatever, you name it. It would have been, the only time they didn't drink was probably 40 hours before a game, or certainly have a few pints. And that was the culture that a lot of those lads brought when I first came into the squad, and that changed.
Yeah, when I first came into the squad, William Kirby from Kerry, the midfielder, who was my club man, he retired in 2005, like a year after I was in, and he was kind of, you know, he said to me, "Er, the crack has gone out of it." And I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Jesus Christ, we're watching videos now, league games. When I started, used to go up in the night before out in Roscommon and go on a right lash on the Saturday and play Roscommon on the Sunday and come home." So he was like, "Andy's right, you're coming from a place where he would have been started 10 years before I came on the scene." So it's drastic change from then to right now to what the guys are now. They wouldn't even know any different right now than the new players coming through.
The one thing we used to probably would be cheat though, because we would always meet up on a Sunday, so all our lads met on the Saturday. So every single Irish player, we'd always come in on the Saturday night to make sure that we get the night out in Dublin before we meet on the Saturday. And that's how we used to do it, yeah.
Was there no self-regulation? You used to self-regulate in Australia, didn't you? If anyone was stepping out of line?
Yeah, we had, Kevin pointed out notice children in the audience, so I don't know if that's a good one to go to, but
how bad is this, firstly?
I know it's not too bad, but like, there was fines and the usual crack. And Christy Cooney, the president of the GAA at the time, I was in charge of the fines, basically. Took it upon myself, and I built up a great kitty. I had about $3,500 after about 2 weeks. Owen Cadigan from Cork probably paid about $1,000 into that, but that's what you get when you ask a lot of stupid questions. But that was the crack. We were slagging fellas if they wore the wrong socks to the training, if they got the fines. But Christy Cooney, the president of the GAA, myself and Tommy Walsh were sitting down on a low seat one day having a coffee in the morning. Christy Cooney came out of the lift and he walked over to us and put on a display of, how would I say, what's the best way to, sex.
He had an itch.
Yeah. And he had no fear of going at that itch in front of our face. And we thought, he went away and I goes to Tommy, "Do you think he did that in purpose? Was like, what was that about, like, you know?" And so I was like, "He'll have to get fined for that." So we were coming back
That was at head level for you, was it?
Oh, face level. It wasn't pleasant. And we were coming back and we trained that night in the MCG in Melbourne, and we were coming back on the bus, and my job every night was to read out the fines from whatever it was, a kick around or a kick around in the stadium or a kick around in whatever training place we were. So I'd get the microphone off the bus driver and I'd have my list made out, and everybody had to pay me when they got off the bus. And so I read out the fines, fellas fine. Stephen McDonald wore the wrong shorts to kick around this evening, $50. Oran Cadigan asked another one of those questions this morning, he's fined $50. And I said, I was looking at the paper, like, and I had it written out, and I was like, "Will I actually say this?" He was sitting on the window side, on the opposite side to me. And I was like, yeah, the biggest fine, and the biggest fine of the week actually is $200 to the president of the GA, Christy Cooney, for putting on the biggest display of ball scratching we ever not have saw. And I was like, I read it out, and there was a big laugh from the bus, and I was like, oh, Jesus, I wasn't looking anywhere, and I put the mic down, I got off the bus, and he was the first man offered the $200 and gave it to me. So we they were all giving out to me. Then the night we won it in Melbourne, they were like, come on, spend some of the money, you've loads of money. And I was like, don't worry about the money, lads. And so the next day we had a, I'd gone on the Friday morning before the game, I did a bit of a recce through the town, my big envelope of cash, kind of going in and out of bars. What can you give us? This is what I have, 3.5. And we'll give you this, I'll come back to you. And went to 4 or 5 places and got the best deal possible, which was free drink from 1 to 7:30 with food on the hour every hour. And it was the sorriest mistake that man ever made. He'd 35 fellas at 12:30 outside the door. So yeah, they were good old days.
Did any part of you, Andy, long for that team experience? I know when you went away, there was a group together, but very much you were responsible for your own success or failure. Did any of you long that you could, at moments, just share with more people?
No, you do. Yeah, you do miss the team. From coming from the amateur squad to becoming a professional, you're very much on your own. And I was actually speaking to Jason Quigley today, who had a similar experience to me, and he used to say how lonely he was. He was living in like Santa Monica, and I would be in similar places. And on the outside, everything looks great. He had a beautiful apartment, beautiful car, training with the greatest trainer alive, me. At the time I was. And like all this stuff, but you're really just on your own, you know what I mean? And so it's really hard to enjoy anything. But yeah, there's a certain aspect of that you lose out on as an individual sports, you know, sports person. But that's the way it is. But like, you know, you get... You're on your own, but you also get all the glory, and you don't have anyone to depend on either. So that's as much as.
You did build quite a tight knit team, though, and like the way you always still talk about Emmanuel Stewart as having that close knit group that at special moments, and like the one thing often sports people talk about, the most special moment is after the success, locking the door to the dressing room, and it's only the closest people to you. Like when you think back to those moments, what are the ones that stand out?
Of course, winning the world title, having failed at it once already, and everything go like completely wrong in the preparation and the fight and everything else. It's weird, you know. You kind of go there with the aspirations of winning, and then you're losing, and you don't really know how to respond to each other, you know. Or even like someone who's very close to me, my trainer, my brother. How do we even talk or address it now that I've lost? You're like, what do you do now? Where do we go? Who? You know, there's a lot of big questions to be answered, but having to go back, rebuild and start again and then win it eventually. And you know that they want it as much as you do. They want it for you as much as you want it for yourself. The amount of work you put in, the amount of work they put in. So you want to win it for them as well, you know. And then just to share it, knowing that they care about it as much as you. That is like, after I won the world title, it was no big celebration. It was no big party. I went back to the dressing room. Just put on the music. Everyone was just nice and relaxed. It was a good time. We went back to the hotel room and ordered room service. That was it, you know. But it was just, there was probably 15, 12 people in the room, and they had been there from the start. And that was probably one of the best nights. It was definitely the best night of my life, yeah.
What sort of people did you want around you, say, in those tough moments? Was it tough love you needed, or did you want an arm around the shoulder?
No, sometimes, like, I'm not sure what it was like for these guys. When you are training like that with a close-knit bunch of people, it's so intense, and you're training together for so long that you actually get sick of looking at each other. You know, like, I would always bring in, like, a friend or someone who was totally detached from boxing, who had no, wouldn't even have a clue or what first thing to talk about boxing, just to have someone, like, for the last few days of training and the last few up to the fight, just have someone just to talk about TV with, or, you know, or other sports or something like that, because sometimes you just get burned out from it, you know, and thinking about it too much and being immersed in it too much. So I would that was one of the main things I would do, would bring in just a friend or call somebody and have them come to the fight, and it would be totally unrelated to boxing.
Yeah, I used to get nervous before games, and it really affected me, certainly in the early stages of my career. I think my career was on such a trajectory from the age of 18 maybe to 22, and I felt as though that, you know, certainly with my attributes, I actually feel as though I look back at my career and I think, yeah, I had a brilliant career in terms of maybe what I achieved and the longevity I had in my career. But I felt as though I probably could have done a little bit more in my career, because I think nervousness affected me. And I look back at my career and I think perhaps it wasn't the thing, the done thing at the time, certainly in the mid to late 90s, was perhaps a psychologist to maybe just to bounce things off and to help me overcome those nerves. The one thing I wanted my whole life, I mean, most people in the room here would support clubs, they would follow certain sports, whatever it would be. Generally, I didn't really support a club, and that's the truth. I didn't really have a club that I supported as a kid. Probably, if you give me one club, it would have been Celtic as a kid. But I was an Irish immigrant over in England, and all I wanted to do was play for Ireland. That was the only thing, that was my one motivator in life. And when I played for Ireland, my first game against Iceland, I think, if you saw it, I know that the lads reminded me often enough, it was an horrendous game. It was one of the worst games I ever played. 45 minutes, I get dragged off at half-time, and I thought my career would crashed and burned right there. I thought that was it. I'd never play for Ireland again. And I just put too much pressure on myself. Maybe going back to what Andy's saying there, you think about it too much. 48 hours for a game. We actually had a testimonial on the Tuesday. We played against the League of Ireland Select on the Tuesday. The Iceland game was on the Saturday. And I played really well, just played my normal game. There was no pressure on me. It was just fine. Go out and do your stuff and do what you need to do. And that was fine. And then I kind of got the impression from Mick, from what was being said, I was probably going to play. I was going to start. And it was my first time ever in the squad. And the Thursday, Friday, I couldn't sleep. I was just thinking too much about it. And I probably needed someone at that time just to bounce something off. And that's what it was. So as I got a little bit older, I certainly...
And did you find someone to bounce it off, or did you just get better at coping with it yourself?
Roommates, maybe just staying up having a... It was just... teammates probably helped me. In those days, they were your psychologists. Maybe I wouldn't necessarily gone and spoke to Mick McCarthy, who was a manager. I wouldn't necessarily gone and spoke to Ian Evans, the assistant.
Who'd you room with?
First squad, I'm trying to think who it would have been. It probably Lee Carsley. I used to room with Lee Carsley in the early days. And then predominantly then for about 3 or 4 years was Niall Quinn. I had a few different partners because it was basically easy. Niall and myself played for Sunderland, so yeah, you two got together and that was kind of how it was. But you relied on your teammates probably a lot more then. You wouldn't necessarily have that individual sort of side of it, which I think now we all recognise it's certainly vital for the team sports, for that individual player to get the best out of himself.
You had a rather unusual pre-match routine, particularly for the big games with Kerry in Dublin. We were doing a summer series with Super Value going around the country, and Sean Boylan cropped up at a lot of the shows. And it turns out yourself and Sean like to spend some private time together just before All-Ireland finals.
Yeah, Sean lives out in Dunboyne. He's a herbalist. He's a kind of healer. He's basically like...
Undescribable.
Yeah, like John Caulfield from The Green Mile, except the Irish version of him. he can fix you. He's fixed certain things. I was struggling with my back last week, 2 weeks ago, to the point I actually couldn't bend over. And I had championship last weekend, and I was really worried, so panic. And it came on me very... I've always had a gammy enough back, but this was pain where it was nothing like I'd ever had before. So I was like, what is this? Where is this after coming out of? And I went up to Sean, and I went up to Sean on a Friday. And Friday night, I went into him, and I was in real trouble. And... he'd done his thing, and it was a Saturday before the, it was 2 weeks ago, it was a Saturday before the, it was Friday before the replay, and it was a Friday night, there was a testimonial for an old coach of mine, Joey Boylan from Glasnevin, a Dub, who was a great friend of mine, always was, always will be, and he was kind of 35 years retiring from coaching St. Vincent Super League team. And they were having a big testimonial game, and your man was asking me for ages to play, and I said, yeah, I can play. And then I rang him 3 days before, and I was like, I can't play. Like, I'm in bother. And I didn't even have boots, and I big enough shoes, so I was going around the place trying to find some fella's boots. So Mike Trimmer, a 6'9" guy, who I called in my book a journeyman, who played with Tralee for 1 year. I called him a journeyman in the book, and I'd forgotten about it. And he goes up to me, he goes, have you a spare pair of boots? No, man, you call me a journeyman in your book. I got a pair of size 16.
And he wouldn't give them to you?
No, he wilted. I was good friends with him, but he was a journey. You are a journeyman. You played with like 19 teams in like 17 years. But Sean would have been, I call over just basically like, as the lad said, a distraction. Sean was that guy that you had, Andy, in the dressing room. I'd go over to Sean in the morning of the game, get away from the team, get away from all the nervous guys, because I was a happy-go-lucky guy, didn't really get nervous. I'd be more nervous playing a club game in Kerry in front of my own people than playing with Kerry, because with Kerry I had so many good players around me. I was like, okay, just do this much and you'll be fine. But I used to go over to Sean, we'd have tea. I wouldn't have any breakfast in the hotel. I'd go down, I'd have maybe a bowl of cereal with the lads, but then I'd shoot off, and it was about an 8 or 9 minute walk. So I used to put on the headphones, find my own headspace, walk down from Dunboyne Castle Hotel, where we used to stay, to Sean's place, and we'd have tea and be shooting the breeze, talking about old games and all things that happened in games, and it'd be me for kind of 2 hours not thinking about the game, and then I'd be trying to get back for the meeting, and then it'd be all serious.
Kev, just to go back to what you said about putting pressure on yourself. Knowing what you know now, what would you do differently, or what would you tell that yourself at 20 years old?
I think the attributes that I had, I said before, I think I should have done a lot better, and it would have been that. Certainly be a lot more relaxed around it. It'll be fine. Certainly go and see someone, and just to get that mental focus right. As I was saying, the only thing I was fully focused on in my life, and it happened quite quickly through my career. Like I said, I was playing for Ireland at 20, so... And it's not really that early, I suppose, in a football or soccer career. But everything just came so easy for me, and then all of a sudden the reality hit me. Look, this is a World Cup qualifier, and I just put too much pressure on myself. I would certainly have seen someone to help me relax and become a lot more. It's not necessarily focused. You mentioned before, I was too focused. That's exactly what it was. I thought too much about it, and it hindered sleep. It hindered everything around the international call-ups in the early days. Yeah.
I read your book and I messaged you afterwards. Unbelievable. Well done. I know you got nominated for another Gill Award or something there. I saw the last day.
Can we vote for that?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah. William Hill, Sports Book of the Year in the UK. Andy Lee isn't
him
nominated.
Yeah, give him a round of applause.
Give it up for him.
But I think you were asking him the question, but I'd like to ask you a question. The walk down to the ring, because, you know, we're going out into the pitch. He's got 10 other guys. I've got 14 other guys that can help me. Or even in basketball, I still got... The mental strength of a fighter, which is what I got out of your book. We know you do the hard work that nobody sees, right? The champion is made in away from the bright lights. But to walk down to the ring, sports psychology, and we had them, and I dipped in and out of it, and I was never fully into it. Did you ever, like, what was your, when you were walking down to the ring for the big fights, like, what's going on inside here? I find that fascinating, that bit down.
Not a whole lot. I don't want to...
You're going to eat something and you're
trying to, like... You're actually... Obviously, it's a really absurd... Like, it's mad, because you're in a dressing room and it's real quiet. Your friends are like... And my mantra in my career was always be like, take the little things very serious and take the big things very light. You know that... So in the dressing room... I would be like putting on music, laughing and joking. I'd always have someone there who would be chatting. I wouldn't be talking about the fight at all. But I would always like my hydration, my sleep, my eating, my weight, all that stuff, the small things I would be like obsessive over. But it is like, you know, it's mad because you're walking out through thousands of people, you're naked, you're going to fight somebody who you don't have no personal ill feeling towards, you know, there's no grudge there, you're just like, oh, we have to fight each other now, you know, so it's a mad thing, but so you're walking, but you're trying to absorb it, you're also trying to stay in the zone where you think like, okay, this is it now, I'm ready, you know, like, and you know, and not to be like, you also think, I'm going to fucking kill this guy, you know what I mean, as well, you are, that's in your head as well, but you're also trying to like, okay, well, there's the crowd, there's the plane, there's the lights, there's, you know, you're just trying to, and feel it, you know, feel it, because it's, you're in the dressing room, it's safe, it's cozy, it's warm, you're nice, and everyone's there, and they're all friendly faces, and everyone wishing you well, and then you're out there, and it's, kill it, you know, everyone, these people are wanting blood, your people are wanting blood, so you have to be, the fight can be lost from, I've said that a million times, but the fight can be lost from that walk from the dressing room to into that ring, you can lose the fight, and I've seen loads of people, their heads are just gone, so it is... It's about managing everything that's going on, also being inside your head and thinking, okay, this is it. Now. Here we go.
I mean, I'll ask you one for me then, Kieran. The one thing...
You can take a seat
there.
No, I will. I'm not going to steal your thunder.
Not the first time.
Just in relation to what you're saying there about, you know, the walkout, the music, everything like this, the one thing certainly playing for Ireland in my mind was certainly the anthem. It meant everything to me as a kid. Being in Irish pubs, being in Irish clubs around the northwest of England growing up, from lads from Kerry, from Mayo, whichever county, you know, it was amazing, I think, time and amazing people that were around me when the anthem was played. But being at All-Ireland finals and semi-finals, when you're playing in those games, how detached can you become when that anthem's being played and you've got 80,000 people in Croke Park singing the anthem around you? Because that to me, I cried when I got my 100th cap. I cried when I got my first cap. I actually cried when I got my first under 21 cap up at Drogheda, up at Home Park. It just meant everything, and it did. Certainly, the last time I cried in a football game was certainly that when I got my 100th cap.
Are you worried they'll play the anthem at Dancing on Ice when you
Yeah, that is a worry now. Yeah, but how detached can you lads become when you're playing in that supercharged atmosphere?
At that stage of it, I was the national anthem. It would have bypassed me at that stage, because I'd be looking at it and I'd be singing away, but I'd be thinking the first few balls is what I used to be always thinking. So I'd be thinking opposition. I'd be thinking what they're going to do in the first position. Are they going to play sweepers? Or that'd be all going, like, it was almost, I couldn't kind of wait for the anthem to finish and then take off down to my spot and be thinking that in the way down. I'd have already had to have thought of that already. So the anthem was almost a bit of calm for me, because you've done the parade and you've done the big hectic warm-up and everything is balls flying everywhere and the place is rocking. I found the anthem a calming thing for me, and I found it a kind of a space where I could relax and think about myself and think about what I had to do for Kerry. And again, when the anthem finished, the cheer from the crowd, and you're turning and you're running down to the Canal End, and there's 30,000 people kind of looking at you, and you're getting ready to go, turn around, who's coming down at me, go over, shake hands with the umpires, try and plumb-ass them a bit, didn't work too much, but try and be nice to them for a few minutes, because they were in for about 70 minutes of abuse off me after that. But yeah, that I always found the anthem a calming place for me to get my head right.
I don't believe me. I was just thinking, I'm going to kill these Mayo men every time the anthem was going on.
No, that happened before.
We do have a raffle that's going to come up in a moment, but I want to put it out to the crowd. If anyone has any questions for the three lads, if you're sitting down there saying, why didn't you ask them that? Now's your chance.
No questions on Roy Keane.
Well, I was thinking when we were at the Borgosh Energy Theatre and Saipan did come up.
You lads bottled it. You never even asked him about it, did you?
No, we did ask him about it.
Well, he always says sticks to the facts. Did you not
ask
him about
the
facts?
He said nothing new. All I wanted to know was, you were the one in the room who sat there and never said a word and could have changed the course of Irish football history.
Well, yeah, and there's probably 30 others as well in the room. I was actually sat right beside him. Roy was sat on my left side. We all turned to Mick like this, and it's like Randy's there. And I was just thinking, shit, I'm going to get punched in the face here by either Mick McCarthy or Roy Keane coming through me. That's what it was, yeah.
Any questions on Roy Keane for Kevin Kilbane?
Has Andy got another game for
him? No. I still go walk around, still, like, I'll think about him, like, what the hell happened to it? Like, it's mad. Like, yeah, it's one of the biggest disappointments. Yeah,
so like, Andy does a rather brilliant Game of Thrones podcast called Off the Wall.
And it was all for nothing. wasn't it? I was going in towards the end, I was like, what are we even, like, what's the point of this? All right.
Thanks for our sponsors for getting behind that. It was a great success. You weren't celebrating their Emmy success, no?
No, the one thing is that they didn't win an Emmy, the two writers, which was a big win for all the real fans, you know, because they were hoping they were going to win an Emmy, but they didn't, so.
Great.
Good.
Anyone else? Down the back, Adrian Barry's got the microphone.
How's it going? Kevin. What is the one thing Roy Keane has as a captain that, like, other leaders don't really have? And do you see any other captains that are coming through that could actually reach that level?
Do you know what? It is a tough one. It is a tough one. What did Roy have as a captain? Roy was, and he spoke about it, if any of you listened to that podcast that the lads did, or the roadshow the lads did, it was a great listening to Roy. There was a few lies in it, don't get me wrong, but it was a great listen.
You should have turned up.
I wasn't allowed to, was I? Never got asked. Anyway, Roy was a very calm, Roy was so calm in the dressing room. It belied what he did when he got onto the pitch. He was extremely calm. He spoke about it again there. Roy just have a cup of tea and a couple of Jaffa cakes. Roy would sit there, wouldn't say a word to anybody else. He was almost in his own headspace. sat there the whole time, maybe the odd word. I played alongside Roy maybe for maybe 20, 30 games in the middle of the park with him, where I played alongside him. And he was very calm even then. He was just, look, the only thing he said to me on a pitch was, don't cross over, never cross over, hold your position. Because if you cross over, we're gonna, one of us, one or the other of us is going to be knackered. So you kind of, if I was playing the left-hand side, Roy played on the right, it was fairly under Brian, it would have been 4-4-1-1 how he would have played. And it was kind of basic how Roy used to like to play. Basic, but simply one of the best, if not the best. I think he's the best midfield player that's ever played Premier League football. And no one gets that because everyone looks at Gerrard scoring from 25 yards. Everyone looks at Frank Lampard with the amount of goals that he scored. But nobody could control the game of football like Roy Keane. Nobody. Absolutely nobody could control the game. And that was, everyone thinks about him as being the intimidating side of him and what he brought to that. Yes, he did have that. Opposition was scared of him. But the way he could control the game, slow it down, speed it up, pass forward, pass sideways, pass back, anything he would do to influence a game that nobody I've ever seen, and I'm talking about it playing alongside him, but also watching Man United during the glory years that they had, nobody's been able to replicate what he could do on a pitch during my lifetime watching games of football. So I think, yeah, probably he will go down one of our greatest, but I couldn't necessarily say what he did as a captain that would be any very different. Roy kept himself to himself a lot around the squad. And he touched on that with you lads as well, said that, look, I was maybe a bit different when I was at Man United than I was with Ireland. He used to stay in his room. He'd rarely come out and really engage. We'd have 20 lads up round playing pool, doing whatever we would do, getting a cup of tea and sandwiches at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And Roy would maybe come up, have a cup of tea and go back to bed. He wouldn't really engage. He generally wouldn't. But there'd be other occasions where you'd be having lunch and Roy would tell the most amazing stories and you'd see the fun side of him, the funny side of him. Then you come down for dinner after maybe training and he'd go and sit on his own on the other side of the room and wouldn't talk to you. So that was the other side of him, yeah. So that was him, yeah.
Decision-making, wasn't it, with him? I would feel like even this current Dublin team, why they're so successful, is their decision-making as a team is always spot on. And that's what I always... Watching Roy, every decision was spot on. It was for the team, bar the red cards, yeah. Obviously, which was the little glitch that you have to put up with for the genius that you had. But
you do have to put up the odd red card, Kieran.
You do, yeah. You do, yeah. Go on, what's wrong with you? I only got two. Go on.
Was the last one this close to a Mayo man?
Yeah, be careful.
I don't know what else I'm going to say. No, I just think with Roy, it's right. You lads would have all watched him and what he did on the pitch. He's certainly overlooked. He's overlooked because he's Irish. Over in England, he's overlooked because he's Irish. And that's a fact. They would always predominantly look at Gerrard and Lampard. Personally, I think he was way better than him. And I played against them for a lot longer as well. Gerrard, yeah, and Scholes as well. Scholes was a terrific. They could do things that Roy couldn't do, but nobody could control a game like him. So I think every one of his teammates said, first pick, if they could sign one player from any club, if it was from a different club, if you're talking about other teams, it would have been Roy. Definitely would have been Roy because of what he used to do and how he could influence a game of football.
Any more before we get this raffle underway and get the drink started again? One for you, Andy.
Hi, Andy. Just thinking of Joshua's last fight against Ruiz, what do you think went wrong for him in that fight? Because obviously he was expected to win easily, but when he's walking out of the change room, he just didn't look the way he normally would.
Yeah, there's a couple of, you could look at it one way and say he completely underestimated him, which I think he did, and didn't expect that type of fight. You know, there was a lot of demand on him for media and all of that stuff. So his preparation was probably completely wrong, because he was preparing for somebody else who he thought was going to be a hard fight, Darrell Miller, and then they switched to somebody who he was considered he was going to be easier. And then when you're in a hard fight like that, and even if it's not a hard fight, if it's a tougher than expected fight, it will have double the impact on you in terms of you're not prepared. You're not prepared for that fight. And so you're not prepared for that type of resistance. So it almost comes back at you. And also, when he was hurt, because he's boxed out, another way of looking at it is that when he started boxing so late, he hadn't built up those instincts that you build up from a young kid of knowing what to do when you're hurt, of how to survive or how to react, and like you kind of go onto autopilot in a sense, and you will continue to box and box well, even though you might not be fully aware of what's going on. And then there's another complete way of looking at it, was where he was winning the early rounds. He knocked Ruiz out hard, knocked him down hard and early, like had him probably out on his feet, But Ruiz had those instincts, survived, but and then while Joshua was going for the kill, he clipped him, and you would have had to see how you've all seen the fight now, because my description is not great. Like, but like he had Ruiz hurt, and going in for the kill, in an exchange, he gets caught with a punch high in the temple and never recovered. Had that punch not landed, had he just smoothed his head a little bit, had he landed his punch, he could have won easy. So there's one sense that he was never prepared for that type of fight, that he was never that good in any way, that he hasn't built up that type of experience. But there's also another train of thought where, had he just landed that punch and not got caught with it, another punch, he would be talking about him having a dominant performance. So that's the kind of the fine line in boxing between winning and losing sometimes is just one punch. And so it's obviously the rematch is so interesting now, and how that plays out. Is it going to be a repeat, or will he box? Will he learn from his mistakes? Because when you listen to him, he's saying it was a punch from God that knocked, you know, it was a punch that he prayed for his whole life that knocked me out. But that would say to me that he's actually not addressing the issues, or that he's not, maybe he's playing kidology, maybe there's a bit of psychology in there, but we'll see. It's going to be an interesting rematch.
Can I ask one question? Just one question, please. Is that okay?
Go on, Kevin, yeah.
My favourite boxer I spoke to Andy about this was Nigel Benn growing up. I used to love Nigel Benn, and quite topical this week, he's come out of retirement. He says he's going to come back fine at 55. What do you think of that? Would you think about that maybe in 4 or 5 years' time if you've got a big payday?
How much are we talking about?
Same amount he's getting for dancing with the staff.
I can't. What could he be getting paid? Would he be getting paid 50 grand? Maybe not. I don't know. Like, who's going to go see it? I don't think anybody wants to see
it. What do you think? He's 55. He's not fought for 20 years, I think. Is that right?
No. It's going to be. But he's fighting a guy who's also been retired for about 7 years, Sakio Bika. But he's a lot younger and tough man. So it's not like he's cherry picking either. He's going to be fighting a real fighter.
Celebrity Fight Club, I would definitely pay good money to see Kilbane and Andy Lee in the ring together. That's
we,
next.
We were down the gym before. Me, Jer was there.
Whoa.
Who else was there that day? Adrian.
Oh, I think Owen as well.
Owen, yeah.
Nathan wasn't.
No, skipped work that day. Next time, maybe.
That was an Off The Ball Podcast Network presentation.